Today's great life was one of the most famous men of the last century. As well known right around the globe as Winston Churchill, Mahatma Gandhi, or Chairman Mao. Before I tell you who he is, though, I want to play you a clip of him being interviewed on the BBC in 1949, the year of my birth.
Now then, there's one thing I'd like to know. Amongst all your characters, such as Goofy, Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, etc., have you got a favourite character of your own?
Yes, I have. It might be sentimental, but nevertheless, it has to be, and it is, Mickey Mouse.
Do you still do the voice?
I do, yes.
Would you like to do the voice now?
I don't admit it. Well, it's such a... Oh, it's such a silly thing for a guy like me to be sitting here talking this way.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Mr. Disney. I know we're all very glad to hear that voice again.
Walter Elias Disney, better known as Walt, is today's subject. And I'm pleased to say that he's been chosen by a cartoonist I enormously admire, Gerald Scarfe, the political cartoonist of the Sunday Times for over 40 years now, and creator of so many wonders and horrors, and sometimes both. Like one I remember celebrating Margaret Thatcher's snatching the Tory leadership from Ted Heath by representing Mrs. T as a nose-in-the-air clipped poodle and Ted Heath as something most unpleasant dropping from the poodle's bottom. Gerald, you're a cartoonist with bite, perhaps even savage in the angles you take. Disney designs are the opposite of that, saccharine, some say. So why have you, of all people, chosen Walt Disney?
Well, I've chosen Walt Disney because I think he has affected my style. I think he was the first person who really encouraged me to draw. My first memory, really, of Disney is when Pinocchio came out. And I was 4 years old at the time, and I remember my father taking me to the Regent Theatre in Regent Street. And we walked in, and to my father's horror, the tickets were 7 and 6p. And that would mean 15 shillings for both of us, and this was far too much for the family coffers. So he took us out into Regent Street again, and we walked away, and me obviously snivelling the whole time, and eventually he relented and took me back in again. And that was one of the best days in my life, really. And I think that ever since then, Disney has been, you know, my hero. And I copied all the characters in that particular film, Geppetto and the Fox and Gideon the Cat and Stromboli. And they really did, I think, affect my style later on.
Have you any particular favourite characters or favourite movies?
Well, I suppose that was what they call the golden period, which was Snow White, Pinocchio, Bambi, all of those, I think. Later on, I feel that Disney wasn't quite what he could have been. I guess I'm always attracted to the wicked ones, like we all are if we go to a pantomime. Who are we waiting for? Not the boring old hero. We're waiting for the villain to come on. And people may not see the grotesqueries in his work that they see in mine, but when you think of the witch in Snow White and Lampwick turning into a donkey, there's some real horror in Disney as well. Stromboli was one, was the man who ran the circus there, and he was an ogre.
It's a peculiar and interesting political aspect to Walt's life, to which we are going to return, I hope, a little bit later on, but right up at the front, I wanted to ask you about it. He starts out as an egalitarian, concerned for his workforce. His father was a socialist. Later in his life, he's eagerly testifying before the House of Un-American Activities, denouncing three of his previous animators. No Bambi he in this case. Is this an aspect of his life that you know or care much about?
I know about it, and it's an uncomfortable fact, I suppose, but one has to judge the work of a person. I mean, I'm sure Gauguin was an unpleasant man in many ways, but that doesn't stop me liking his work. It seems impossible, yes, when he testified against his own animators, his friends, so-called, and called them communists. That was unspeakable, really.
You say there's no connection, or no necessary connection, between the human being and the talent, but something about the whole Walt Disney ethos speaks of the American dream, doesn't it?
Yes.
And you like that?
I like the American dream part, where a man could come from nowhere and become a sort of... leader of the world, almost, in Walt's case. I mean, he's known throughout the world. You can ask anybody, I should think, in Taiwan or Zambia, they would know who Mickey Mouse was and who Walt Disney is.
Also with us, we have not one but two experts on the life of Walt Disney, the broadcaster and co-author of The Disney Studio Story, Brian Sibley, and also the animator, Richard Williams, Dick Williams, the creator of Roger Rabbit. Before we plunge into the detail, I just want to ask you, Dick, what Walt the man was like? Because I believe you met him as a young prodigy, aged 15.
Yes, I was Disney-struck, got on a bus from Toronto and went to Hollywood to try to get in, and walked up and down in front of the gate.
You were 15?
15.
Yeah.
I met Disney and he saw my work and said he was very impressed. You can imagine what that did for me. But more interestingly, I went back on a painting trip and I got invited somehow to a screening for Look magazine of Peter Pan, which was incomplete. And Disney was about 6 feet away from me. And he had a woman in a green dress and red hair up against the wall. And he was Svengalying her. She was mesmerized. And he was trying out Lady and the Tramp as the dog goes upstairs. And he was going, he was doing this thing, and she, it was shocking. And she was going, "Oh, Mr. Disney, Mr. Disney." And I thought, "Christ, is this my hero?" You know. And then later I realized he was just doing his job.
Really? Are you sure?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And they said, his best guys told me, he said, he was working all the time. He'd just grab anybody he could and trying everything out on them and getting the reaction. And I found myself later on when I had a studio doing the same sort of thing.
I've always thought that's one of the most fascinating things about Disney, actually, is that so many people have criticised Disney the man as being somebody who didn't do so much. He didn't draw all the pictures, he didn't do all the voices, he didn't do this, he didn't do that. He was a thief of other people's talents. Yeah. But in fact, the consummate skill that he had was as a storyteller. And if you talk to anybody who knew him, who worked in the studios, everybody will say he became Mickey Mouse, he became Pinocchio, he became whatever was required, and he acted it out and lived it, and they went and drew it. So he was the kind of origin and genesis of so much of this stuff.
He was a great actor, as good as Chaplin.
Brian, starting for a moment at the beginning, the origins, his family background, it's believed in Norton Disney in Lincolnshire that the Disney family come from there. Is that true?
Well, there's all kinds of origins going right the way back to French origins before that. The immediate predecessors of Walt himself came from Ireland. There's also connections, as you say, over here and in France. So this man comes out of the archetypal melting pot of America. That's, you know, this man is born in 1901. He's born on the cusp of the change of the century, but not just the change of the century, but the change of America from rural world to industrial urbanized world. And what I think of when I look at the early Disney life is there's this boy who was born in Chicago. He had this father who was a bit of a loser, really. He had endless jobs, worked on the railroad. He ran a jelly factory. He had a farm. He worked as a building constructor. He did all these kind of things. He was a Micawber character who was constantly trying to do things, constantly failing. And what you see when you look at the early Disney work, the early Mickey Mouse films, is you see this conflict between the animals in the farmyard, Mickey Mouse, Clarabelle Cow, Horace Horse Collar, all these characters, and then you see them all adapting to live in the city, this new city with skyscrapers, and they're people who clean clocks at the top of high buildings, or they're building buildings, or they're working, you know, it's almost like you take a rural character and then you squeeze them into the city, and you see in these films the outworking of these two huge influences on Walt's life, which is the rural and this burgeoning urban life.
Are we overanalyzing here, Gerald, or are cartoonists really importantly influenced in these ways?
No, Brian's not over. No, he's splendid. Not overanalyzing at all. But of course, yes, an artist is a receptor for everything that's going on in society, if he's working properly. I mean, it's an artist's job to represent society in an interesting way, hopefully.
So small-town, rural American background, a poor father, a bit of a loser, and the young Disney begins to draw. And he's not an immediate success, is he, commercially?
No, lots of commercial and financial disasters, including being bankrupt at 21. There's a lyric in one of Disney's later live-action movies, And the lyric talks about stick-to-itivity, and I think that's really what Disney had. It's a bit corny, but, you know, he had the ability to keep pushing on. And of course, he begins with some rather crude animations, and they were sort of really rather feeble versions of fairy stories updated. But then he gets this idea of taking the animated idea and putting a live action actress, a child, into an animated world, and he creates what was called the Alice comedies, and it was based on the idea of Alice going into Wonderland, which a book which had had a huge impact on him when he read it as a child.
That's a really original idea, isn't it? Putting a real human being into an otherwise illustrated world.
Well, animators had played with the opposite. They'd had the idea of animated characters coming into the real world,
yeah.
But this was a reversal of that. So it was innovative. It was absolutely what established his name. I think there's a very significant thing happened around this time, which is that he and his brother formed a company called Disney Brothers, the Disney Brothers Studio, and a decision was made at some point to change the name of the company from Disney Brothers to the Walt Disney Studio. And that, to my mind, is the key move, because what he decided to do was focus everything on his own persona, his own identity. This wasn't some amorphous thing like MGM or 20th Century Fox or Columbia or Paramount.
It's a perfect thing to come in with. Roy Disney Jr. told me that Roy would fight with his brother Walt. Roy said, you know, when we were poor in Missouri, Walt and I used to have to sleep in the same bed. And Walt had this bedwetting problem. And he used to piss on me every night. And he's still doing it.
Did you, Gerald, have such
bed a... bedwetting problems?
Such a fitful start as a cartoonist. Was it all plain sailing for you from the start?
Oh, God, no. It's a very difficult job being an artist. I mean, no one really needs artists or think they need artists. And it's... my father was in banking, and he wanted me to go into the banks. And luckily, because of lack of education, I failed all my auditions, or whatever they're called. My father naturally thought that being an artist is a dodgy job. And I often wish, you know, if he were alive today, I would say, who's got the dodgy job now, bankers or yeah. or artists? I don't think being an artist is a very easy thing, despite, you know, one sees Tracy Emin and Damien Hirst to appear and then make huge amounts of money. It's not like that, really, for most. And I started in a commercial art studio, and I was drawing things that I didn't like. I was trying to make shoddy goods look glamorous. So I think that my later work was an overreaction against that, you know.
We're about to turn to Mickey Mouse, obviously. Is there a Mickey Mouse in your life? Is there a cartoon that you drew, a caricature that you created that you feel sort of founded you, got you going, took you off?
No, and I think it's a mistake, really, because when I first started at the Daily Mail, Bernard Levin said to me, you want to invent a character that will carry you through, and I didn't quite understand it in those days. But if you have a character like Mickey Mouse or Schultz's Peanuts, Charlie Brown, people will follow that, and it becomes a part of their history. And I haven't got anything like that, and I regret it, really, when I look back. And I suppose the only people who've kick-started me are Mrs. Thatcher and George Bush.
Yes.
I would have said we'd followed many of your characters, actually.
I think so, yes.
Including Ronald Reagan as Mickey Mouse, actually. Yeah.
But there is no continuing character, you know. I mean, some artists put a little mouse in the corner themselves, because that becomes their symbol.
Brian, I love mice. I loved mice as a boy. I was an almost obsessive keeper of mice. So Mickey Mouse, to me, was, well, what really hooked me on to Walt Disney as a child. It was presumably rather a controversial idea to make your central character a mouse, was it? How did Mickey Mouse, how did he evolve?
Well, he was a creature that came out of adversity, really, and his success is actually steeped in previous failure, because Disney had created a character called Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, and he couldn't have been more inaptly named, as it turned out, because his distributor, it turned out to be very successful, and his distributor very quickly decided they could make more money out of it, and they could take his animators, and they could cut corners, and the long and the short of it was that Disney lost the Not only lost the deal, but he lost the rabbit as well. And he had to create something new. The thing is that Mickey isn't terribly original. Felix the Cat looks much like Mickey Mouse, looks much like Oswald the Rabbit. But what Disney had, and it's just totally fortuitous, having created this character or come up with the idea, there's a hokey story. It was based on a little mouse that he had as a pet in his Kansas City studio. It was actually created in terms of its visual appearance by a guy called Ub Iwerks, who was a very close associate of Walt in his early days.
What's that name again?
Ub Iwerks. And as somebody at the studio once said, Ub designed Mickey's physical appearance, but Walt gave him his soul, not just his voice, which we heard earlier, but his soul as well. But what happened, of course, was that Al Jolson sang for the first time in a movie, in The Jazz Singer, and sound was suddenly an issue. All these cartoons have been silent. So suddenly Disney, the innovator, said, I'm going to make a Mickey Mouse film with sound. It wasn't the first, it was the third film that he'd actually made. Made it over, it became Steamboat Willie, and when it premiered, it changed the world. It changed the world of cartoons. And Mickey's success isn't just because it's well designed and it's a funny little character. Its success is because it rode in on this miraculous thing of being able to squeak.
I always found Mickey rather boring, actually. I think that, you know, he was rather sort of... I much prefer Donald Duck. He was an aggressive kind of character.
Yeah, I think
character.
He became boring. I mean, I think in the early days he was much sort of...
What do you think? Inventive. Yeah. Very inventive early on, and then he flattened out.
Well, he became a kind of corporate symbol, and when he became corporate, Disney couldn't do anything with him.
That's right, he behaved himself.
Yeah, exactly.
It said that he was originally advised that a mouse wasn't a good thing for a cartoon because women didn't like mice.
Yeah, I've heard that story. I mean, I don't know whether there's any... You ever heard that, Dick?
No. I mean, pay no attention.
And it was originally called Mortimer Mouse, is that right?
Yes, it was Mrs. Disney who said that Mortimer sounded completely stuffy and not right.
I think the thing about it is that he didn't invent the animated film, but he might as well have, because he took it in such a short space of time, from 1925 to 36 when they did Snow White. It's ridiculous. Incredible growth. He made a completely new thing that nobody'd ever seen.
I think it's fair Eisenstein to say he made an art form, really.
Yeah, he turned a crude series of gags into an art form.
You're listening to The Great Life of Walt Disney, chosen by the great cartoonist Gerald Scarfe. Also here, we have author and Disney-phile Brian Sibley and the animator Dick Williams. And before we go on, I just want you to listen to this recording from the opening day at Disneyland in 1955.
The grounds are loaded with about 15,000 people who are especially invited guests of Walt Disney's. And they're here from movie land, from motion picture and correspondence, from every possible kind of activity connected with the opening of the eighth wonder of the world. In fact, I think I'll get off these tracks right now and go over and meet some of the people here waiting for the train to come in. Diane, you're six. Where would you like to go of all the places in Disneyland?
To the great big castle where Sleeping Beauty is.
Oh, you want to go to the castle. Sharon, you're eight. What would you like to see?
I think I'd like to go to see Frontierland when Davy Crockett fights the Indians.
Davy Crockett. Robert, what would you like to see?
I want to take the boat trip down the Congo.
Ronnie Reagan, come on in. Isn't this a riot today?
Oh, it certainly is.
And Ron, your first job is down here in the town square.
Right out here in front of the depot, yes, for the Main Street and the parade and so forth.
We have lots to do. Get busy.
Okay.
So long, Ron. Thanks for coming out.
Ronald Reagan, a previous subject on Great Lives at the opening of Disneyland in 1955. Gerald, time to spill the beans. You've actually worked for Disney, haven't you?
I have, yes. Back in the 70s, I worked in Chicago and New York. I had a gallery there, and I worked for Time magazine and did Time covers. And there were two students at that time who were kind enough to say they were fans of my work. And when they grew up, they became Disney directors and had a huge success with The Little Mermaid. To my amazement, one day, they just rang me and said, how would you like to be production designer on our new feature, Hercules? You bet, I thought, you know. And I joined in, and I designed all of the characters and some of the backgrounds. I mean, I was very nervous about it because the history of Hollywood is of chewing people up and spitting them out, Scott Fitzgerald onwards. But it was the greatest experience I've ever had, I think. It's the nearest thing I always say to being Tom Cruise. I'll never get any further. When it all ended, I had severe limo withdrawal. I used to go out and look for my car, and it wasn't there anymore. But it was a very, very tricky thing to do because I had to teach, or try to teach, Disney animators to draw in my style. Everything at Disney when I was there had to be cute. Oh, it's not cute enough, you know. Why does it have to be cute, I used to say. And apart from the villains, everything had to be, you know, nice and hunky-dory. Some tried, and some got fairly towards my... with the wickeder characters.
Mm.
But some people didn't try at all. And so it was a very frustrating experience. It lasted for about 3 years overall, I suppose. I did the designs during 1 year, and then director looked over the animator's shoulders and said, this nose is too long and these ears are too big, rather like a school teacher for the rest of the time. And the film at the end, I suppose, shows some of my influence, but I mean, I just lost out to Disney. There were 900 of them and one of me, so who's going
to
win?
And it's fair to say that there was really a sort of school of Disney. What do you think, Dick, about the cutification or Disneyfication of European fairy tales? I mean, they're kind of spoilt for me when they're Americanized.
Yeah, well, but in Snow White and stuff, in the very beginning, Pinocchio, it was much richer. I mean, they were trying everything.
Yeah. In fact, if you look at the film, which obviously had a huge influence on Gerald Pinocchio, what you're seeing there is actually the work of European artists. Yeah. I've always thought there's also this thing that it's an overcritical response in that fairy stories, world myths, are something which are handed on there largely in the oral tradition, and then they become something that's passed on and reinterpreted by every generation. And I think that the Disney just gave another interpretation. The thing is that film is so strong and so compelling and backed up with, of course, a huge merchandising marketing organisation. Those images then become iconic and become unchanging.
We talked briefly, Brian, at the start about his political change, Walt's appearance before the House of Un-American Activities. You knew some of the personalities involved. Can you explain how it came about?
The strike at the Disney studio is immensely complicated. It's complicated for all kinds of reasons. The chief one, I think, being that Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, as Dick was saying, really did revolutionise everything, but it also made for Disney a huge amount of money. And he built this idealised studio. Gerald's been there, Dick's been there, I've been there. It was laid out to look like a university campus. You know, everything was provided to make the best environment for the people working there. But what happened was that all the work that they suddenly plunged themselves into meant that there were suddenly not just a few hundred artists working there, but thousands of people were working there. And suddenly this initial relationship which had existed between Disney and his artists was no more. There were all kinds of systems and protocols. And you then enter a period when everything in America is thrown up in the air because you've got the rise of industrial disputes, you've got all kinds of studios being closed down, struck. Disney Studio is targeted by the union bosses who want to unionize the animators. Disney says, fine, call for a ballot amongst my men. And that is the beginning of what becomes an agonizing period, which then ends in a walkout of, I think it's fair to say 40%, 60% of the people crossed the picket line, but a very messy and a terrible period.
But the main guys stayed with him.
Absolutely.
And they said the effect on him, because he's a young man, was like a stroke.
Yeah.
But they just turned on him, and he just thought that drove him into the arms of the right wing.
And maybe broke his idealism.
It did. And it ended the golden... That's when all the experiment... That's when Stromboli and the Pinocchio turning into a donkey, all that went out the window.
There were rumours about anti-Semitism, even about Nazi sympathies. Anything in any of these rumours, Brian?
I knew one of his closest associates, a guy called Joe Grant, who was really the man responsible for so much of the design of the characters. Joe was Jewish, and Joe was really Walt's right-hand man. And I've talked to Joe when he was alive about it, and to his wife, and they both said they never saw any evidence of it. In point of fact, Walt would actually choose to, if he had to go somewhere and needed somebody to go with him and his wife to an event, would choose Joe and his wife. So it's been one of the things of which Disney has been accused, but I don't know what Dick's feeling on it is, but I've never come against anybody who's given any tangible evidence.
No, Art Babbitt, who led the strike, who was the fourth highest paid guy in the industry at that time, working for Disney, and he hated Disney, or love-hated Disney. He was Jewish, and that may have helped people say, oh, he was anti-Jewish.
I think it's extraordinary that he can bring together all these mavericks. I mean, if you go to the Disney studio, which is very anodyne and very, very clean and set out, all of the artists there have got little cubicles set up. And they've made these little cubicles their own world. They put drawings and pin them on the wall and almost cover the door with them, which says, keep out. That's their little province. So he had all of these extraordinary extrovert introverts that he had to kind of mould into one thing, which
he
did.
And when he died, they all went for each other. They're tearing each other. Peter Ustinov did a voice there, and he said, "Oh, Disney's all these old men tearing each other to pieces." And that's what he held. It wasn't like that when they.
No, he held them back.
In November 1966, X-rays revealed a huge tumor on his left lung. This was removed, but he died in December. Who took over?
Well, the corporate people took over, really. There were his brother certainly had a huge responsibility, and he then took on Disney's final project, which was the creation of what was originally to have been called a Disney World, which became the Walt Disney World in Florida. But really, in a sense, it was, as Dick has already indicated, it was really up for grabs, and a lot of the animators were wanting to carry on but didn't quite know how to do so. And the corporate people were saying, look, we've got all this stuff in the vault. We don't need to do any more. We've got all these old films. We can keep releasing them forever. We don't need to make any more. So it was down to a group of people who stoically said, no, we've got to do something new. And they went on and they finished Jungle Book, which was half completed when he died. And then they made Aristocats. But it was a difficult, rocky period. Whether it's what Disney would have done, as Dick has already said, I doubt.
Well, we may find out, because there were rumours, apparently, that he'd had his body cryptogenically frozen.
Not true.
You're sure of that, Gerald?
Well, he was burnt, wasn't he?
It would be a very Disney-like outcome, wouldn't it, if he managed to come back to life?
Roy Disney told me, he said it was rubbish.
I think the first cryogenically preserved person actually happened after Disney's death, but it's exactly the right kind of story for people to believe in. Had he gone off to Avalon like Arthur and was just waiting, sleeping for the moment when, you know, the animation industry would collapse and he would be called back from the mists of time to
Hello.
Put everything right. So I can see why it happened. I can see why the story is there. What fascinates me is that despite all the evidence to the contrary, it's still endured across all these years.
Yeah, and that hello has still endured that we just had from Gerald. So a final question, Gerald. Do you think if it hadn't been for Mickey Mouse, we would never have heard of Walt Disney, or would he have invented something else?
He would have invented something else, I'm absolutely sure. He was a driven man who had to do what he did, and it's amazing that he came from a poor farm boy, whatever he was, to kind of world status. It's quite extraordinary. The only sad thing now, I feel, is that animation is no longer drawn in that old-fashioned fashion. And
Some of us are still scribbling.
Dick's doing it. Dick's holding the flag for us all. But I think, you know, that being an artist, there's nothing more magic than drawing a certain move.
My thanks to Gerald Scarfe, who chose our great life, that of Walt Disney, and to our expert witnesses, Brian Sibley and Dick Williams. Goodbye.